Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone. This is Madhuri, and you are listening to New Books in South Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we have Snigdha Poonam joining us from New Delhi in India to talk to us about her new book, her first book, Dreamers, How Young Indians Are Changing the World. So Dreamers came out earlier this year in January in India, and then has just been republished in the US by Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for joining us, Snigdha. This is such a great honor for us.
Thank you, Madhuri, for having me.
So, you know, before we jump right into the book and your process throughout writing it, interviewing your interlocutors, let me just begin with how you got into journalism.
Well, you know, like all good Indian middle-class parents, mine try to push me towards more profitable occupations. So I studied science in school and college, but I just wasn't into it. And I think that I spent all of those years in classrooms just reading and trying to write stories. And so the moment that I was like out, I just knew that I had to, quickly do something. So I started sending articles to newspapers, and some of them did okay. So that's how I began.
Okay. And by profitable professions, you mean, you know, the usual lawyer, engineer?
Engineering. I think that for me, their dream was that I become a doctor. And I'm so happy that I didn't go down that path.
Right, so when you speak to some of your interlocutors, you're familiar with that net of aspirations that they're trying to cast, I guess, because we've all been subjected to that same disciplinary reach, right? You know, there's been so much talk both within academia and media at large about India's demographic dividend, how in the last census, almost 50% of India's population is below the age of 24. By 2020, India will become the world's youngest country. I mean, you know, we are so familiar with these statistics by now. And of course, all of these are concerns for economists, but also present tremendous potential for politicians. And, you know, we saw how Prime Minister Modi has harnessed this potential to great success. But what I so appreciated about your book was, you know, how you draw these seven very specific individuals and paint a picture for the reader as to how they are actually enmeshed in these currents. The joblessness, the embattled aspirations, the, you know, the masculinity in crisis. And so I thought I'd, you know, ask you first to talk a little bit about your interest in small town India, right? Your a very specific deep dive into the tier two city. So for our listeners in the US and, you know, those who might not be familiar with the term, will you begin by telling us a little bit about the B town, the tier two city, and what specifically drew you to this milieu to understand young Indians?
Sure. I had been working in Delhi as a journalist looking at all of India. And as you said yourself, I mean, there are just so many of young Indians, hundreds of millions. So anything that anything big that happens in this country centers around them, whether it's elections or riots and or, you know, marriage or love and dating and so on. So nearly everything that I was covering as a journalist took me to young Indians in various parts of the country. And the kinds of things that I heard amazed me more and more. I mean, just to give you an example, I think one of the big stories that I did as a journalist in Delhi long before starting on the book was one on the entry of online dating in India. And it began with just one website that was trying out the market. So I signed up to, you know, I was working towards a long form feature. So I signed up as myself, although explaining on the website that I was a journalist and the kind of stuff that I wanted to ask the people on the website. And within hours, I think that by the time that I woke up the next day, I had hundreds of messages from a young man from across the country, from places that I had never heard of, you know, from Saharanpur in north to Salem in south. And I was surprised that very few of them actually were trying to engage me in conversations about love or sex or, you know, the sort of stuff that you would expect. But most of them just wanted to talk to someone who was interested and talk not just about love or sex, but just everything, you know, their families, their college, job prospects, just how dislocated they felt and just the things that they wanted to get out of their lives. And it just intrigued me. And I thought that there was just so much going on in the lives of young Indians in small towns and villages that we didn't have any idea of in the cities. So that kind of pushed me towards thinking of this book. But there was so much going on in Delhi itself. I mean, I remember during the same time going to a personality development class because they were springing up everywhere and they were full of the same kind of young men and young women who came from places all around Delhi, much smaller places all around Delhi, to really just figure out how to, you know, how to change their lives, how to be in a big city, how to market themselves, how to get a job, how to sound smart and just like be cool. And I remember also going to this workshop that was called, because I used to scan the newspapers for advertisements for events that were like calling out to young people. And one of them was just called How to Become Rich. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty straightforward. So I went and similar kind of situation, young men, mostly always young men. And they were very driven and very desperate to make something of their lives. And most of all, to break out of whatever, you know, boundaries that they were kind of fitted in. And I kept thinking that whether it was like love or aspiration or just or society, they wanted some really big changes. So therefore the book.
And what was their relationship with the big city? Because I remember at one point in the book, I think this was your spoken English tutor, and you ask him if, you know, he wants to expand the business, take it, you know, to a metropolitan city. And he says that, you know, he'd actually prefer to remain where he was. I think this was Ranchi. And so I'm curious, you know, we consume so much Bollywood and literature with this trope of the villager with, you know, starry eyes, moving to the big city to fulfill his dreams and ambitions. But I think there's also a little bit of something else going on here, where it's not such a straightforward relationship of emulation. Is that something you noted too?
Yes, I did actually. And it kind of really surprised me because, I mean, growing up in small towns, I mean, all I wanted to do, all any one of us wanted to do was to leave.
Immediately, as soon as we could.
Yes. So, you know, whether you wanted to be a journalist or I don't know, even launch a company or something, you couldn't imagine doing that without leaving. But that had changed massively. And other than one person in this book and that who wants to become big in Bollywood, no one really leaves their, their small towns. And I think that surprised me. And I think to some extent, they didn't feel the need. And that was the biggest reason. I mean, there is this guy who is able to launch a website for viral content in English, mm-hmm. based in a town in Madhya Pradesh. So then he figures that he doesn't have to go to Delhi to make it big in the media. And you can imagine how like shocking that was for me, because I kept asking him, so what's next, like Delhi? Because it is the headquarters of Indian media. But he said, why Delhi? I mean, I'm thinking of next to Singapore and then maybe LA. So I think his trajectory is very different. So whether, you know, you take motivation speaking or spoken English or, you know, politics, I mean, none of these people saw the need. And some of that was like attributed to their having found these tools, this like one-time tools of sort of like modernity that they could use to change make their own market. And they always spoke of markets, like each of them, almost all of them spoke of markets and making a market for themselves. And so whether you take English or you take internet or even
confidence.
Yes. Or even like event management, these were things that they used to make, build markets for themselves. And they had rightly figured that, you know, creating a market in a place where there's none is better than like, you know, entering a market that's already becoming saturated.
So your interlocutors are largely men with a single, very inspiring but also disappointing exception of Richa Singh. So was that something you originally intended, or is that just how things panned out in terms of connections and long-term relationships?
Well, two things happened. One happened earlier on, which was that I found it more difficult to get that time, they get the kind of time and engagement that I wanted for this project. So, you know, and I realized that was always going to be the case, because it was easier with men to just arrive in their lives at any point that I wanted to, and to like just stick around while they went about their business. So whether it was with their families or at their work or while they traveled or they hung out, I could be there. But for the women, although some of them were interested in, and I was really interested in them, some of these stories fell through because, they had to constantly ask their families for permission to spend time with me or to allow that kind of access into their lives. And in some cases, they just got, like one of them just got married off and they left, and she left in the middle of our association. So, I mean, some of this was just like logistical difficulties. But then the more I got into the project, the more I realized that the kinds of things that the men were telling me were very specific. And it would be hard to like fit both men and women into this larger narrative of wanting change, because the things that the men wanted were very different from the things that the women wanted, and very, very telling reason. But while the men kept telling me, as you will see in the book, that they wanted the biggest things, you know, they keep telling me that they want to be the richest person in the world or the most famous motivational speaker or the biggest like politician, that sort of stuff. The women were mostly struggling to, you know, fight for the most basic of freedoms, such as, you know, to study, to work, to leave their homes, to marry when they wanted to, or to someone that or to whom they wanted to, that sort of stuff. So I felt like when I spoke to women, they weren't talking to me about going to Mars or becoming prime minister of this country or leading the world or changing India. And so I just wanted to focus on that. And even the story of Richa Singh, who's trying to fight a student's election in a very patriarchal part of India, was to show how she's up against that kind of masculine aggressive force. So even that story for me became about more about as about the men that she's up against as about her.
Yes, that incident where you accompany her to that student election rally where the crude bombs go off was pretty crazy.
Yes,
will you tell our readers maybe just a smattering of incidents that were crazy on those lines as you were investigating these life trajectories?
Sure. I mean, for many of these stories, and because I was dealing with a young man, I had to, and as I said before, I wanted to be everywhere at all times. Sometimes I had to just be in situations that I wouldn't otherwise like imagine myself getting into. One of them was while following the election journey of this 27-year-old woman called Richa Singh in Uttar Pradesh, which is India's largest state and, you know, among its most patriarchal as well. And so we're talking about one of the biggest universities in Uttar Pradesh, in which one of India's largest or most massive scale students' union elections happen. And for, I think, about 128 years of this university's existence, no woman had ever stood for the post of the president of the students' union. And suddenly this 27-year-old decides that she's going to fight this election. And the whole university explodes in outrage, and so does the whole city. So it was just one 27-year-old woman against thousands of men of all ages in this city who just wanted, in whatever way they could, to stop her. And if they couldn't, and then to defeat her. So this 2 months through which she first campaigned and then went through the voting process and then actually emerged out winner was a very violent time for her and for me, because I was following her. And not just verbally, because it was very common for her to receive these phone calls threatening rape or threatening bad things for her family, but also for her and for me too, and for some of her female supporters to just be surrounded by men or to be like literally faced off across the street. And and sometimes, you know, this involved SUVs and bouncers and bombs and you know, I mean, at least one point this woman just flung herself on one of these men who were protesting her speech as part of a mob. And so she breaks her arm. I mean, I was not there fortunately that night, but so I mean this whole process was extremely risky. And I realized while doing that there was no way that I could ever fully understand why she did that. why she would take such risks when it, you know, she could lose. There was so much for her to lose: her family safety, her dignity and body, and her life as well. And I don't think that I still understand. But one of the stories that I just will never fully get into, because I remained in shock almost throughout. But that also meant that I was one of the people from the book who I respect the most for the decisions that she took.
Yeah, and you know, by the end of that chapter, when you know you read that she has decided to contest elections for the Samajwadi Party, which is one of the biggest parties in UP. I mean, on one hand, of course, I was disappointed, because I think as an independent, she was really eking out a space that was separate from all that muscle, corruption, power that she had begun critiquing during her first foray into the political realm. But then, as you just said, the risks and sacrifices that she had already made and borne, I think it's unfair for her to have to carry all of that on behalf of, you know, all the women who are silenced and who can't up and do more. I mean, she had already done so much, you know, and so I think I felt I really had no right to be even disappointed that she decided to join a mainstream political party that also adopted the very same tactics electorally that she had initially resisted. So it's complicated, and I hesitate to write that off as co-optation in the end. But yeah, I'm so glad that you had that story in, because it just magnified the toxic masculine aspect of the Indian youth and how they engage politically and intellectually in this moment. I mean, you just have to go on Twitter, I guess, to get a virtual sense of that. But this was very visceral.
Yes. I mean, in a place where it's risky for women to walk between their homes and their classrooms, you imagine this woman just walking the streets, making speeches, sometimes climbing the walls and taking over stages to campaign and to mainly speak to like hordes of men. It was just bewildering. But you know, I mean, I like the fact about her, at least towards the end of the reporting process, that she wanted to play this game of politics and with in all its imperfections. So she was idealistic but not naive, and I think that the further she goes, the more I see that she will go far. And but also that, you know, I mean, if people like her don't join parties such as Samajwadi Party, then like how will things change? So I'm glad that she's,
you know, you began by talking about your immersion experience in the dating website. And so I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about your journalistic practice, I guess, for a lack of a better term. I mean, how did you find these seven people? Well, with the exception of Richa Singh, I guess. I guess Facebook was a big forum to reach out to some of these men. But I mean, how did you sustain the relationships? Did they, you know, continue to want to be in touch after you had wrapped up the story? Have they read your work? Have they read your book? I mean, what is that relationship like in each of their specifics?
Okay, you'll have to remind me if I'm forgetting any part of this question. I didn't have to make much effort to find people, because I was already in a lot of places talking to people. And I had realized that that young people, no matter where they were telling me things that were very interesting and kind of same sort of things. The idea was to just be in one place and identify six or seven people and then follow their journeys for a year or 2 years. And I began in Ranchi, where I grew up. But towards the end of my first year of this project, I got kind of bored and I started going out a little bit and talking and traveling to other cities, smaller cities, and talking to similar people. Finding them was not at all difficult because, as I said, I mean, these places are full of young people who just want to talk and who want very big, very dramatic things from their lives. But I, having said that, I did immerse myself in the online and offline worlds of young people. So I would hang out in colleges and coffee shops and radio stations and fashion shows and a ton of just Facebook and WhatsApp and all kinds of like websites and comment chains and all kinds of corners of Indian internet where I would really get a sense of what was going on. But I had a really hard time choosing people because there were so many people who were saying such interesting things. But I wanted to find people who wanted things that for me seemed very unlikely given where they were in their lives. Whether it is, you know, there's a guy who wants to be a media mogul who's from small village in Haryana where no one speaks English and no one has studied beyond class 10th. There is a guy from a small village in Haryana whose parents sold milk for a living, who wants to become a spoken English instructor and a world famous motivational speaker. That, you know, that sort of stuff. So, and I wanted them to give me access. So I explained to each of them that it wasn't just one time interview, that I will just stick around for at least a year, just keep following them as they did whatever. And most of them were very friendly to the idea. So that was easy. I think that initially I began as a straightforward journalist, which is what I had been doing. So I would meet them and I would ask them questions and take notes as much as possible. But the more I went along, the more I realized that that wasn't necessarily the best way to do this because it was creating a lot of distance between us. So I think after some months of the whole interview and note-taking, I just began to relax more and more and kind of just, you know, it became more and more informal as we went along. And I realized that if I wanted that kind of entry into their lives, I also had to open myself to them a bit more. So I think that for a lot of these interactions, I would, you know, speak about my life for half the time and they would ask me questions because as curious as I was about them, these were young men who had never met. For most of them, I was the only woman outside of their families in their lives. So they were very curious about me. And so I just began to talk to them about all sorts of things, sometimes things that I wouldn't even tell my friends or didn't have time to. So it just, I tried to remember as much as I could so I could take notes when I went home. So that kind of became more and more that kind of interaction. And but I explained to them over and over again what this was going towards and what the final thing would look like. And I told them how long it'll be and what kind it is, just like it'll be, I mean, just how like multidimensional this was going to be and what it, and also the importance of what their stories meant for the larger future of the country. And most of them understood it. They were very open and very articulate. And sometimes they told me things that really made me look at everything from a fresh perspective. Some of them have read the book. Most of them haven't. I really hope that it'll be translated into Hindi. They are mostly happy, although they keep telling me that they would like it if some of these stories were turned into kind of video format so that it would be easier for them to share. Some of them have been optioned for film and TV, so I hope that at least one or two of them end up being made. And I think that would be the best way for them to have this.
Yeah, I can see how a video format would allow better circulation, especially with all the WhatsApp groups and Facebook pages that they all seem to engage with through so much of their daily waking hours. So, it's hard not to conclude from your book that if, say, you're a young man from small town India, frustrated for whatever reason in your search for a livelihood, chances are, right, disproportionately, that this young man is also a Hindu nationalist, a Modi supporter, right? And were there other ideological directions that you saw young Indian people moving in?
Yes, I think there was a fair amount of curiosity about the political scene, most of the political direction in which the country was going. And I did see a lot of support for, or at least curiosity about, the Aam Aadmi Party, a mostly Delhi-based political party that entered the political scene trying to position itself as an opposition to the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, so a sort of an alternative to the Congress. And because, as you've seen in the book, they keep blaming the Congress Party for whatever, whether fairly or not, about all the things that have held India back, that I saw that many of them were playing around with the idea of supporting the Aam Aadmi Party, but nothing at the same scale as their adoration in all forms.
Right, because frustration and restlessness and anxiety about the future can go several directions, but when combined,
but not just that,
but when going to say, combined with a certain cultural nationalism, it seems to be channeled more towards a Hindutva angle. So,
but channeled, I wouldn't put it that way. I think that's a very what the BJP and what Mr. Modi especially has done is to give them a narrative that they can hold on to and champion. So I'm not saying that everyone needs to be spoon-fed their identity politics, but for a lot of young men, I'm talking about people who are as young as 19 or 20, who just feel frustrated with their lives, just find that, that they find resonance in the things that the BJP's leaders are telling them. And they don't find the same kind of resonance in what they hear from big political leaders otherwise, who, if they are making big speeches about poverty or secularism or equality, it doesn't make sense to them. But when we're going through some of the speeches that Mr. Modi made before the big election, the central elections, last central elections in 2014, seemed like he was talking in their language, the kind of stuff that they're attracted to, the kind of stuff that they look up on YouTube all the time, and the kind of stuff that gets them going, the stuff about dreams and stuff about how they're all of their combined potentials being wasted for years and years, and how just one chance will change everything. And so that kind of like hyperbole, that kind of extreme promises, and you know, that kind of also like just solidarity. At the same time, they also told me that they like how he's and more BJP more than any other party is active on internet and social media, and it just makes them feel more. It just like makes them feel that they're more on the same, more on their page than any other political party.
Right. And where was I going with this? I had a follow-up question. But okay, so what are you working on now? Are you writing a similar book but with women interlocutors?
I am trying to research a book, and I wanted my next book to have a woman at its center, because I'm kind of tired of listening to young men who started to just, it's been a bit much for me. So I am working on a book. I'm looking at love in India through crime. So it's going to be very intense experience as well. I've just started, so I wish I could say more. But I'm choosing one story as a continuing narrative through the book, and that features a woman who has killed a man. So we'll see how it goes from here.
I just remembered what I was going to ask you, following up on the Modi being on young people's page. So you also at one point in the book talk about how, you know, young Modi supporters are immune to any statistical counter evidence. They don't really want to hear quote unquote proof that things on the ground have actually been otherwise, that the Gujarat model hasn't been successful quite in the way that it's been portrayed. Did you also have similar arguments with your interviewees? And how did that necessarily conclude?
I did. There aren't so much credible statistics as they are able, like most people in their generation, to find statistics that will support their argument, whether, you know, false or real. So they, you know, they trust the internet for everything. And so when you argue with them about, say, Nehru or what India's growth rate was before the independence, they will scan the internet and find just the kind of numbers that they need. And so it doesn't matter, you know, what the source is. It doesn't matter how, you know, what the research is or who's being cited. Or so that happened a lot in some cases. I did, I would have debates with the young men, and they just almost always defeated me. It didn't go that well.
Well, I'm already excited to read this second book that you say you have in the pipeline. But I think what you already have here is so important, because, you know, it gives faces and stories to just trends and statistics that we read about in the news, and makes it so much more real, I guess. So thank you for writing this, and thank you for joining us here on New Books Network today. I wish your book all the success, and
thank you, Madhuri. I had a wonderful time talking to you. Thank you for reading the book, and thank you for featuring it on the wonderful show.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Bye-bye.